This is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live, my friends, welcome. It is your weekly one-stop shop for the strange and the unusual, the one and the only. Yes, it is the Grahamian Report, and I'm joined in studio as always. Well, first, I guess I should tell you who I am, if you don't know already, those of you who are first-time listeners. I am the veritable mouth of the South, not the one from Tasmania. No, I'm the one from right here in the heart of the Mohorovic discontinuity. That little dark disquiet, that dark corner of the web known as the Grahamian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and of course, joining me in studio are the gentlemen who helped make this program what it is on a weekly basis. Across from me, the producer, the co-host, the man in plaid, the milkman himself, Mr. Chris Hayes. Chris, how are you?
I'm really good. I'm just wondering who the hell is the mouth of the South in Tasmania. I'm trying to make that link.
You're going to find out here in just a moment.
Okay.
And sitting across from me on the master console here at Grahamian International Studios in the beautiful, bright, sunny Asheville, North Carolina. You know, it hasn't been really all that bright and sunny today, but we're glad to be here nonetheless. Mr. Matt the Reverend Oakley. Matt, how are you?
I'm fine, but I just want to know, how do you know if it's bright and sunny up there? We're this far underground.
Look, I read the weather, okay?
Yeah. Well,
even if
right.
I haven't been to even if I haven't been to the surface world in days, maybe weeks at a time.
Just in case we have to make an emergency run to the surface, I guess.
Yeah,
know
exactly.
Know how to dress.
We all have to be prepared. You know, when you live in a cave underground, a bunker, a fortified bunker actually is where we are. You know, mineral water down here is great, let me tell you. But, and then there's those slimy little catfish things, but I digress. Yet again,
Chris,
my friends.
Chris is the only one brave enough to eat them.
That's right. Tonight, my friends on the Grahamian Report, those of you who have never listened before, you're in for a wild ride, and of course to our weekly regulars, welcome again, and we're so glad to have you. Look at this. We've got field correspondents literally calling me right now. I'm live on the air.
Well, you must have that really good cell phone plan where you get reception hundreds of miles below the surface of the earth.
Well, you've seen cell phone towers, right? You know, that stick up out of the ground.
Do we have inverted towers?
Yes, we have inverted.
Stalactites?
Stalactites.
Yeah, they got to hold on tight so they don't fall. So
yeah.
Towers, upside down
towers.
That's the way that, well, you know, if you're underground, you have to be able to find ways to work this stuff out. So, yes, we've got stalag towers that broadcast Verizon's 3G and soon, I understand, 4G down here to the Mohorovic discontinuity.
Oh, no, 4G's already down here. I've got it.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Did you get that worked out? I did not know.
Yeah, it cost an extra squiggly billion dollars, but...
Well, we don't want to talk too much longer about the stuff that the impatient listeners are just going to fast forward through. You know, we want to get right to the meat of the conversation because that's what we do. We bring you the latest red meat in the world of the strange and the unusual. This week, I have to tell you, folks, we've got a lot of interesting stuff. We're going to be talking about strange creatures out there in Earth's oceans. I've had a theory about sea serpents for a long time. We've talked about it a little bit on this program before in the past. And I'll just tell you, I think that there is a very plausible case to be made for the existence of sea serpents and that there is actual, biological, scientific proof for this. We'll talk about that a little bit tonight on the program, in addition to some of the newest in drone technology. We like to talk about drones a lot on these on this program as well. And I'll tell you this, did you know that there are a team of researchers who have now used Bluetooth technology to rig up a way to literally control a drone with your mind? Imagine that, remote-controlled drones, controlled by the power of one's mind alone on the battlefield. And then, of course, during Hour 2, our special guest tonight, Nancy Duterte. Psychic intuition, everything you ever wanted to ask but were afraid to know. That's what Nancy's going to be discussing with us tonight on the program. She bills herself as the skeptical psychic. That's what drew her to our attention. Because we are, well, we're a bit more of the skeptical ilk on this program just as well. And always glad to have you joining us, sharing your own observations of the weird, the wild, the wonderful stuff out there that constitutes our reality. Getting to the listener emails, Jim writes, you know, I ran across an article that you wrote a while back at the site grahamianreport.com. That's right. You know, if you download this podcast each week, don't forget about the accompanying website, grahamianreport.com. The article was Mysterious Mountain Lights, an update on unexplained lights in the Linville Gorge. Now, this, of course, had to do with a segment that we talked about on this program. Actually, I guess, guys, it was probably about a year ago that we posted that article, and we did a subsequent edition of this podcast where we talked about the Brown Mountain Lights. That's something that's very near and dear to us here at the Graylian Report because we are, well, almost within the vicinity of the Linville Gorge. Matt, have you been down there to the Linville Gorge to see the Brown Mountain Lights?
Yeah, of course.
You have? How recently have you been down?
It's actually been about several years since I've gone, but...
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, well, I think this is really a travesty. I haven't made it down one time this year. But the most recent trip I made down to the Linville Gorge, get this, was with one of our field correspondents, Chris McCollum. It was last Halloween, and I was down there literally the night before Halloween. So we got down there at about 10:30. We stayed until well after midnight, and so we saw in Halloween, of course, at Wiseman's View. And yeah, we were seeing, I don't know what they were, but we were certainly seeing some strange illuminations that evening. None of them were distinct enough to qualify as what are known as the Brown Mountain Lights. But Jim, who writes us this week, certainly says that he had seen many years ago something very similar to what I have described in various articles we've posted over at the site. He says, your description is pretty much like what my girlfriend and I saw after rock climbing in the Linville Gorge. This was back in the mid-1990s. However, in a different location in the gorge from where you described. He said, we were hiking back north toward Table Rock after climbing near Shortoff Mountain. It was dark already, and we were at a... Well, he gives the coordinates. We won't bother people with the numbers right now. But he says, we were on the very east side of the gorge looking west across. And the lights that we saw were, well, on, as he puts it, or maybe moving about the mountain across the gorge from us. The west wall, as it were. We were perched on a rock right at the edge of a series of cliffs, looking out into the gorge, and we watched these for 30 minutes or so before they finally disappeared. There were no roads and no major footpaths over in the area where we saw these lights. And besides, these lights, well, they were swooping what would have been hundreds of feet at a time, way too fast for a car or any kind of a human to be able to move, especially over that rugged kind of terrain. The lights were like what you described, but there were only two of them together. And they'd float. They'd be pale green for a while. They'd float simultaneously, kind of in a vertical position, relative to one another, and then the two would go back to a horizontal position, and then they'd change colors from green to pale red. Now, I'm a skeptic myself. In fact, I'm pretty scientific, and I thought about everything that I could in terms of how I could explain this. Atmospheric conditions, you know, it was a very clear, calm night. Maybe some sort of refraction or a reflection. Maybe the lights of small towns far off in the distance. I considered everything I could, but nothing could explain this. Well, Jim sent along a visual. He took one of my own photographs that I've included over at graylianreport.com that seems to show these lights. This was taken by a friend of mine, fellow researcher, Bob Ashmore. And Jim doctored the photograph so that it shows roughly what he had seen back in, I believe it was the early 1990s sometime. He said, again, it's been 16 years since I saw these. The fluctuations between reddish, yellowish, greenish, well, I can't remember exactly what the sequence was, but if they were both red at the same time, or one was green or one was red at a time, they tended to change their position relative to one another. He says, your photos, on the other hand, though, do seem to catch almost exactly what I'd seen that night. The same general size, the same general brightness, and the same general circular shape. Glad someone else has seen these. Very best, Jim. And you know what's funny is I have never really seen conclusively. I've seen some questionable illuminations down there in the gorge, but very seldom will you ever visit Brown Mountain and actually see something that, well, is without question a quote-unquote Brown Mountain light, okay? Now, the classic really good sighting would be something along the lines of this. You're standing there at maybe Wiseman's View. This is in the Linville Gorge, and it's a very beautiful, beautiful landscape that you see there. In fact, the Linville Gorge is often described as one of the most majestic views east of the Mississippi, almost comparable, at least on terms of east coastedness, to the Grand Canyon. It really is gorgeous. You're standing up there on a cliff, and there are these two little, for lack of better terms, turrets up there that you can kind of stand in, and you can look out. One is closer to Table Rock in the distance, and the other is closer to another adjacent mountain of similar shape called Hawk's Bill. And often, from the tops of these large stone outcroppings, one will begin to see these lights take shape, okay? One will begin to see these strange lights appear. These things will appear, and you'll literally begin to see these things sometimes drift up off the mountain. and up into the air. They'll hover in the air or they'll move around. Sometimes they don't ever leave the gorge. In the very best stories that I've ever heard about the Brown Mountain Lights, people will be up there at the Wiseman's View Overlook. They'll be observing Hawksbill and Table Rock in the distance, and as these lights actually appear, get this, they'll drift across the gorge and fly directly overhead. Or some people have said, we've been standing there at Wiseman's View and these lights touch down, so to speak. They'll come across the gorge airborne, they'll fly over to where the people are, and they'll come and they'll hover nearby, sometimes even come down almost to the ground as though they were observing people. You know, last week on the program, we read an email that William had sent along talking about when people had shown flashlights and laser pointers and things at the Hestelen lights, a similar sort of earth phenomenon, earth light phenomenon in Hestelen, Norway. And they talked about the fact that when they would shine these laser pointers at these lights, that these objects that would be flying along and flashing would start doing double flashes when a laser was being shown at them. And according to some interpretations, this might seem to indicate some sort of an intelligent behavior, or if we were to be a little bit more, or maybe a little less conclusive in terms of what what we term intelligent behavior, at very least these things were showing some sort of an interactivity, okay? And as we're watching these lights, the researchers said, they would not only change their pattern, but on one occasion they said that one of these things seemed to, fire some sort of a laser-like light back at them. Now, that certainly seems to qualify as being intelligent-esque. The Brown Mountain Lights, on the other hand, I don't know that people have shown lasers at them and these sorts of things, but people do seem to feel like these lights interact with them. I personally hold that they are some kind of a non-intelligent, natural, luminous electrical phenomenon. But I've had other folks tell me that they've seen these things drift across the gorge and hover so long that they literally felt compelled to all gather together and say, cheese, as though this object were taking their picture, and then it'll depart and head back over toward Table Rock. Very mysterious, even if it is some sort of a natural phenomenon. And yet, I was talking with my uncle just yesterday about the Brown Mountain Lights, and he is a very good electrical engineer. Graduated from NC State University, and is well known in the Asheville area as an electrical engineer. And I asked his perspective on the phenomenon, and he said, well, as far as I know, they remain inconclusive in terms of, or rather, they remain unexplained. There is no conclusive explanation for these lights. And you'd think that something that is so repeatable and so apparently observable, well, people should have some sort of a general idea what we're dealing with after all this time. And yet we don't. They remain a mystery indeed. Very strange. Taking it down under, I just spoke with our good friends Benjamin Grundy and Aaron Wright of our sister podcast, The Mysterious Universe program, just last night. Listen out for a upcoming appearance by yours truly on that program. In addition to Scotty Roberts, we're talking Paradigm Symposium and the like, and we were discussing the details of that particular event, the Paradigm Symposium, last night with Ben and Aaron. And I told him, I said, I've got the funniest email this week. I assume that this gentleman may be a Mysterious Universe listener because he too is from Australia. He's certainly a Graylian Report listener. And he says, hey gang, just a quick email to say hi and thanks for the excellent podcast. The best part is you seem to mention Australia almost every week in some way. Well, that's because we have so many good friends down there in Australia. Maybe next year, the Graylian gang will have an opportunity to actually visit Australia. Who knows? Luke writes with a couple of questions. He says, Micah, what's your band's name and where can I find more of your stuff? Well, I'll tell you this. I play with a bluegrass group called Nitrograss. You can learn about us at nitrograss.com, but you'll soon be hearing, I'm very excited to announce, this is the first time I've said anything about this, you'll soon be hearing some very new music from yours truly. I have a brand new project that that I'm undertaking right now, musically. And it's something I'm very excited about, and I'm certain that the folks who listen to this podcast each week will be excited too, because we'll feature some of that music on the show in the coming weeks once this project reaches completion. It's underway right now. I've always got about three or four different projects underway at any given time. In addition to the UFO Singularity book that's coming out this December, there's another book that will be actually released prior to that we've hinted about on this program. Let me just tell you this. If you like ghosts, well, we've got one that's going to be really good for you this Halloween. haunted stories and the like, but not just like collections of stories. This is my own personal experience, along with the personal experience of Chris Hayes and Matt Oakley and others close to this operation. It's going to be all featured in this new book that we'll be telling you more about in the weeks leading up to Halloween. We've also got some great special guests lined up, but anyway, I digress. That's the latest on the music for you, Luke. And he also writes, I usually hate techno, but I love the video game style that your brother Caleb has put together for your show. He reminds me of the days wasted on Commodore 64. It is great stuff Caleb does for us. He says, if I donate some sexy Australian dollars, can I make my own Graylian Report t-shirt? You know, that's a great idea. I think we need to actually have everyone out there do that. Make your own homemade Graylian Report t-shirts and then show up at the local supermarkets and things like that. What's that, Matt?
And send us pictures, man.
Yeah,
we need
right.
to see these.
Because then the best design is going to be put on our official t-shirt that we'll soon be offering for people. You know, I wish you could have those in time for Paradigm Symposium because people keep asking about Graylian Report merchandise.
Well, since you've put it out to everybody else, you put the responsibility on essentially the world, then, guys, it's up to you. Get us a new design before Paradigm. We're not mad. We're just disappointed.
That's true. Luke also writes, can you please have an Australian guest on one day soon? He says, there's almost no well-known Australian paranormal researchers. I'd love to hear our brutal Brogan Aussie accent cutting through your listeners' ears. But I'll tell you, one of our field correspondents, actually, is Andrew Nicholson of Weird Australia. Of course, Ben and Aaron of Mysterious Universe have on many occasions offered to come on the program. But, you know, the problem is that whatever time of the day it is here, it is opposite down under, and therefore we have to, you know, align our schedules very carefully. So he says, thanks, keep up the good work. Graylian Report is the only paranormal podcast that is consistently interesting and fresh. Well, thank you very much for that. P.S., Luke writes, I once knew a girl that was referred to as the Mouth of the South. She was a Tasmanian, Lady of the Night. P.S.S., and this one goes out to Chris Hayes, producer rhymes with seducer. Ha, that makes a lot of sense. It's all clear now.
Yes.
It's all clear now. Yes, indeed.
I'll be at the Paradigm Symposium, folks.
He will be. You know, in fact, we're all going to be at the Paradigm Symposium, and as many of you out there as can join us, we hope to see all of you there at the Paradigm Symposium just as well. When we come back from this break, we'll be talking more about the strange and the unusual. We've got some really bizarre stories I've hinted at a little bit already, and maybe we'll get into some discussion about sea serpents just as well before we begin our discussion with Nancy Duterte. Tertre on Psychic Intuition. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and there's that ever-loving song we were hoping to hear. Why is the producer looking at me like that? He's just like, what's going on?
He's in seventh heaven right now. Somebody called him a seducer.
He likes that, doesn't he? Well, seducers, reverends, and south mouths, all alike. We are the Graylian Report. We'll be back right after this.
Have you ever looked up at the stars at night and wondered, are we really alone? Could there be other life out there? And could it have influenced life here on Earth? This is George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, and I'm excited to tell you about the Paradigm Symposium 2012. It's an event being held this October 18th through the 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota. If you've ever wondered about the mysteries of our universe and of our ancient past, this is the event for you. And it's not just a conference. The Paradigm Symposium will feature unique presentations, a banquet dinner, and guest lectures by me and names like Eric Von Daniken, author of Chariots of the Gods, as well as Giorgio Tsoukalos, Philip Coppens, and many others. Tickets are selling fast, so reserve yours today. And all you have to do is visit ParadigmSymposium.com. That's ParadigmSymposium.com. Reviewing our past, changing our future. The Paradigm Symposium 2012, brought to you by Intrepid Magazine and The Graylian Report.
Back. Welcome to the program. It is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, the one and only Mouth of the South. You know, I've heard Ted Turner calls himself that, too. Slightly synchronistic. And speaking of synchronicity, I want to give a brief shout-out to my good friend Laura, who's in the chat room tonight. Always glad to see friendly faces out there interacting with us here on the program. You know, you can listen live. We stream live every week. Ustream.tv. All you got to do is just do a search for Micah Hanks there on the Ustream website. You can find us easily enough. 8 p.m. Eastern time on Tuesdays, but of course we know everyone likes the podcasting format. I've talked with a lot of radio folks these days, and even the big-time radio broadcasters offer podcasts because of the popularity of listening on demand. It is quite wonderful, isn't it? And therefore, you can put us in your pocket, literally, and take us with you everywhere that you go. Synchronicity indeed. And speaking of synchronicity, Darren writes that I was driving down the freeway just yesterday in Calgary. Now, I was listening to a local sports radio, which usually dedicates itself to the Flames and other local sports teams here. They were talking in depth about the Ottawa Senators. Now, Ottawa is around 3,000 kilometers away, and I figured it would only be a quick spot, and so I listened on. But the Ottawa talk went on for at least five more minutes. Wow. Now, I should mention I was in kind of a foul mood at the time, and I remember saying, not thinking actually, but saying out loud, "Who the hell cares about Ottawa in Calgary?" I went to change the station as a vehicle came up alongside me. The couple inside were both just staring at me, and I thought, what are they looking at? Right at that moment, as they sped past, in the back window was a giant Ottawa Senators sticker with Ontario license plates right underneath. Away with that little moment of synchronicity went my foul mood as I had to just let out a chuckle. Thought you guys would get a kick out of that. Keep up the great work, and I can't wait to meet you guys in many. Well, there's another one of our listeners who's coming to the Paradigm Symposium. I tell you, we have a special announcement about the Paradigm Symposium as well, especially those of you out there in the Minneapolis area. We are now offering, in addition to the three tiers of tickets that you already have had available for the event, we are also now offering day passes for folks who would like to attend just a particular day. This will be especially appealing to folks who don't have quite as far to travel there in the Minneapolis area. So for our listeners in the Minneapolis area, you'll want to check out ParadigmSymposium.com. Right at the top of the page, you'll see a link that says Day Passes Available, and you can learn more about the day passes that we're offering for the event there. And I also hear, since Ben and Aaron of Mysterious Universe are going to actually be coming all the way up from Australia to join us at Paradigm Symposium, we're going to be getting into some rather unique, behind the scenes, after hours meetups and things like that with Ben and Aaron. In fact, they've already announced, I believe, that there's going to be not one but two Mysterious Universe meetups while they're there in town. And boy, you know, I thought Paradigm Symposium was going to be well attended. It is, but you know what? We may be rivaled by these Mysterious Universe meetups. They're coming up for our event, and their meetups are probably going to be as well attended as the event itself. So that's going to be pretty great. And for those of you who are listeners of both programs, we'll hope to see you at those Mysterious Universe meetups just as well.
Well, that's why we're going to be with Ben and Aaron during the meetup, so we can claim half responsibility for it.
So
they don't get all the glory.
I told Aaron that Aaron said he wanted to dress as Austin Powers at the Paradigm Symposium and asked if that would be a problem. I just love it. Austin Powers walking around.
Absolutely not. Do it, please.
I said he'd have to be Aussie Powers. But that only on one condition, that that Chris here dress as Austin Powers' dad and follow him around.
No. I'm dressing as Paul Bunyan, which is essentially just what I wear.
That's
on a
how
daily
you're dressed
basis.
Right now. That's
plaid and a beard. I just need... Does anyone have an ox I can paint blue?
Oh my gosh.
And an axe that you won't get squeamish about.
He just needs a great big old blue bull. That's right. I love those blue bulls. Blue bulls are great, but... Or is it an ox, technically? I guess
it's... No, yeah, it's an ox. Like, blue bull is what happens when you don't have your ox.
That's right.
Like,
if you can't get your ox on, you have blue bulls, right?
We're going to give you an ox, and then they just take that ox away before you can have it. Then you get blue bull.
That's right. Yeah, you don't want blue bulls.
That's a close second.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah, give the guy his ox, right? You know, I hear one British author... Matt, what's the problem over there? One British author recently, actually, apparently, he got his ox on, and he saw... a ghost. Matt, you sent this story along earlier today. James Herbert, Britain's number one best-selling chiller writer, disclosed in an interview published on BBC News. You know what had happened was he had made a bet. Who did he make a bet with, Matt?
With good old Stephen King.
That's right. Yes, the famous reader of audiobooks, and he writes also. But Stephen...
Man, I just want to put it out there. Hands down, one of my favorite American authors, or authors in general, is Stephen King.
Yeah.
You know, your reasons for not liking him be damned, Matt. He's great. But I just can't buy the new Stephen King, the new Dark Tower book, uh-huh. because normally the last four were voiced by a guy named George Guidel, who's mm-hmm. amazing, but this next one is voiced by Stephen King himself, so it just sounds like...
What's it going to sound like, Chris?
It's going to sound like a guy from Maine reading a book.
give us a sample.
I'm not really good with the Maine accent.
You're rolling on that road.
It's going to be like, and then Roland went to the general store to see about where to find the Dark Tower. And he asked where the Dark Tower is, and the guy says, I don't know, but you can't get there from here. And you also don't want to go down that damn rod.
Are you sure?
It's sour out there.
I'm not so sure that Stephen King talks like that, though, Chris.
Yeah,
or that
kind
he
of.
Constantly references Pet Sematary and everything he talks
He actually
about.
Does constantly reference Pet Sematary and Salem's Lot all through the Dark Tower.
But have you read Salem's Lot, though? That's a great book.
Salem's Lot is good.
It's an incredible book. Yes. You know, there's that line.
Callahan is just...
Incredible character, dynamic character. You know, Ben Mears, when he meets that, what was the heroine's name, I guess? Susan, right? When Ben meets Susan toward the beginning of the book, he has that famous line, "From such inconsequential beginnings, dynasties were built." I would agree, he is one of the greatest American authors, and all dispute, you know, notwithstanding with regard to the nature of his accent, well, his writing is indeed very good, but apparently... James Herbert beat him to the punch in terms of seeing a ghost, a real ghost. Indeed, yes. Herbert shared his own personal encounter recently with a ghost during an interview about his newly released book, Ash. It's a novel about a paranormal detective who investigates a haunted castle. According to James Herbert, he and a friend were sharing a few drinks at a hotel before heading off to bed when the friend noticed a shadowy figure pass by the doorway. Okay? Herbert did not see the image but continued to watch, and then within about 10 minutes, the shadowy figure walked back past the door. This time, Herbert was walking. Well, he recalls bolting to the doorway, there's a difference, to investigate the shadow, only to discover the marble hallways and the marble staircase were indeed empty, despite the shadow he'd seen. Well, when asked if he thought the drinks might have played a part in his experience, Herbert responded with, "No, I'm not like that. If I've seen something, I've seen it." Now, although James Herbert did not disclose whether he won the bet with Stephen King, he did imply that he had. No further details of the bet were indeed revealed. Chris, have you ever seen a ghost?
I haven't, no. No, I've never seen a ghost.
Okay, well, now, I personally have not either. And you and I have actually, you know, I stopped just short of saying ghost hunt, but now we have been looking for ghosts together.
Well, I was going to say we've gone ghosting before.
We've gone ghosting together. You know, I'm fascinated by ghostly phenomena. And here in our hometown of Asheville, there is a veritable psychic laboratory for the eager ghost hunter known to a few as the Reynolds Mansion. And I am very excited to be able to tell you. You know, we mentioned a while back because we did a live broadcast from Reynolds Mansion. I am very excited to be able to say that we have a new book that will be coming out here from the folks at Grailian Report very soon. It's called Reynolds Mansion, An Invitation to the Past. The gentlemen are seeing the cover artwork here right now in studio. This new book is the true story, the history and the strange happenings that have occurred at this place we know as Reynolds Mansion. It is a southern antebellum home, one of the largest and longest standing brick structures in western North Carolina. And let me tell you, Chris and I have spent a few several occasions, both night and day, up there. Matt has joined us for a live broadcast we did from Reynolds Mansion. I've spent many evenings there virtually alone in the place. Chris has taken photographs at the place. I have talked with virtually everyone who has come there in an official capacity, from historians to famous authors to all the employees, the owners, the family members of owners, the family members of the past residents of the building, the former owners. I've interviewed everyone I could for this book, Reynolds Mansion, An Invitation to the Past. That's exactly what it's going to be. It's going to be an invitation to the past, and that's what we go looking for, the hidden residents, if you will, that I believe seem to remain there at Reynolds Mansion. And this doesn't have to do with going into a room with meters and stuff like that and looking for something. This doesn't have to do with going in there with ghost detectors and with tape recorders and things, although Chris Hayes and I did a very lengthy and rather very involved, I would say, EVP recording session together at Reynolds Mansion.
Yep, in every room.
We went almost every room. We went to many rooms. We asked very calculated questions. You know, we had one of the owners of the building join us for one of those sessions. And, you know, after reviewing the audio, sadly, I have to say, I found no evidence of any spirit voices. But that doesn't mean that there haven't been all kinds of other things that have occurred up there, all kinds of other things that have been seen at Reynolds Mansion.
Well, yeah, last time we were up there, you kept freaking out, saying you saw some guy out of the corner of your eye.
Well, you know, there's that thing that happens when you're in an old house at night, and, you know, the natural ambiance, if you will, you know, you'll think you're seeing things. I won't say I've conclusively seen anything. I've had strange impressions, but now other people, though, certainly have seen things. They've seen, there's an older gentleman, very tall, wears a tan waistcoat. There's a young girl who's believed to be the spirit of a girl named Annie Lee Reynolds. All that'll be in the book and just in time for Halloween, so we'll have more for you about that very soon. You don't want to miss that. You can look for more information about that at GraylianReport.com. Before we run out of time, I do want to get to a couple more stories. There's this incredible footage that came up. This, I think, was linked at the RT.com website. The headline read, "Alien or Jelly Freak? Deep Sea Monster Video Whips Up a Storm." My dear friend and I were looking at this earlier today. I showed it to her and I said, before I tell you anything, I just want you to take a look at this video. Tell me what you see in this, okay? Tell me what you see in this video. It is very strange. It's fascinating. It's a sea creature captured underwater on camera, reportedly filmed during a deep sea drilling operation off the coast of Brazil. This is not the kind of thing that is very often seen, I'll tell you that. And at first glance, this what they called a cascade creature. They literally thought it might have been a mold-covered plastic bag drifting by the camera, but then this object begins to reveal very slow yet very graceful movements. Indeed, it is apparently some kind of jellyfish. Brown in color, the creature is as flexible as an octopus, but it doesn't seem to possess any protruding tentacles, and still it can boast rather white pendulous tubes that are reminiscent of how a jellyfish moves along as it kind of makes its way through the water. This is a very, very, very unique bit of footage. And Matt, reach over there behind you. There's a book and a document sandwiched inside that. Hand that over here to me, because when it comes to what may or may not exist underwater, okay, this footage just goes to show. Now, although this creature had apparently been seen once before many, many years ago, some believe that this may be a very rare kind of jellyfish, which is given a name, I think, what's the name? I can't recall exactly the taxonomical name that was given to this thing, but let's just call it a very enigmatic-looking creature. And what this goes to show is that, indeed, there may be things in our oceans that few, if any, know about. In other words, animals that somehow remain unknown to science and that have remained as such for a long, long time. Animals that, despite the knowledge that we have today of life on this planet, these are animals that, well, cryptozoological in nature, remain hidden from view of most. And thereby, people occasionally come along and they'll have glimpses of these things, and yet we seem to remain almost blissfully unaware of their presence. I have here a book published by the G.P. Putnam Sons Company back in 1963. It's not a book you're going to see an awful lot.
Is that a dirgopal on the inside? That's a dirgopal.
I believe so, yes. That is, yes. As a matter of fact, dirgopal is German for the jellyfish. And there are some reports of UFOs that actually resemble large jellyfish, and hence one Danish website had referred to one of these things as a dirgopal. But we'll have to talk with Billy, one of our German field correspondents. He's actually a Brit who's in Germany, and he's associated with another UFO organization who I shall name at another time at his request. But this book is called The Mystery Monsters. Gardner Soule, okay, was a journalist who in the 1960s took a fancy to the study of strange monsters and just penned this little book, and I came across it one day. And it's fascinating because he opens with this following passage that I want to share here on the program, which so brilliantly kind of prefaces where we're going with this portion of the conversation. He's one of the United States' greatest experts on animal life in the sea, and yet he was completely baffled. Here he was, aboard a ship on the Atlantic, just off New Jersey, and there it was, a big animal, very close at hand, heaving on the surface of the sea. And he didn't recognize it, didn't know what it was, and doesn't to this day. The expert who was stumped by an encounter with a monster of the deep was Dr. Lionel A. Walford. His job is that of director of the Sandy Hook Marine Laboratories of the Bureau of Sport Fisheries and Wildlife of the Department of the Interior. He's used many years of his own experience and study to produce a thick book called Living Resources of the Sea that in his field is a standard work. It is a book men refer to when they want to know something about sea life. Now, there's nothing in Dr. Walford's book, however, about this mysterious animal, this creature that he had been looking at on that day. It appeared long and thin like a serpent might. It resembled a transparent sea monster, Dr. Walford afterwards said. It looked so much like jelly, I could see no bones, no eyes, no nose or mouth, but there it was, undulating along, looking as if it were almost made of fluid glass. Now, pay very close attention to what's being described here. An undulating, serpent-like, and yet completely translucent creature swimming along near the surface of the water. Dr. Walford said it was about 40 to 50 feet long. 40 to 50 feet long and from 5 to 7 inches in diameter. Other witnesses said it was much bigger. Other witnesses, there was an entire boatload of these. Altogether, there were 76 knowledgeable witnesses, including Dr. Walford, aboard the 85-foot research vessel known as the Challenger, when this transparent, unknown animal had been sighted. These men are all either scientists or skin divers or sailors or fishermen, men thoroughly familiar with life out there in our oceans, and yet they were all out there studying how waste matter dumped into the oceans affect life in it, and this thing shows up, this unknown animal, and it puzzled them all. Not one of the men on the Challenger stepped forward to identify this mystery monster. Not one of them had even ever seen anything like this or had the remotest idea what it was. They could only stand there and watch. So what was it that they saw that day? You know, I'm fascinated by these sorts of stories, and yet apparently something else very similar was seen shortly thereafter. In fact, it appeared in an area called the Mud Hole, which is off of Asbury Park near New Jersey. The second appearance of this unknown animal did not make it any better known. To this day, apparently, it remains a total mystery. But these events might not have been surprising if they hadn't happened 100 years ago to one of the early explorers of Africa. At that time, and in an unexplored region, a man might have come upon something huge and new and strange, but Dr. Walford and his associates, they met their mystery monster in July of 1963. What was this? What was this strange creature? You know, it reminded me of a similar story, reading of Dr. Walford's account, that occurred in 1930 aboard the Danish sea vessel known as the Dana. It was a research vessel, and on board was a man by the name of Anton Bruin. They're off the south coast of Africa, and he was out there searching for new kinds of exotic sea life. And even by 1930, of course, most of the scientific community thought that the large and best-known varieties of animals on planet Earth had all been discovered. And yet, pulled up in the nets aboard the Dana that day, Dr. Bruin found a very, very strange animal indeed. Much like the creature that one of his predecessors would describe seeing 3 decades after the fact, close to the east coast of North America, Dr. Bruin had seen a large fish-like animal, approximately 6 feet long, but completely translucent. He was fascinated by this. What could this creature have been? And after completing his dissection of the animal, he determined, without any kind of doubt, that what he was observing was a leptocephalus, okay? This is, in other words, a creature that is the larval form of an eel. Now, the problem with leptocephalus, and if you get online and you look up leptocephalus on what is it, Chris?
I just my memory's sometimes bad. Did we either discuss something very similar to this on the show previously?
Oh, we've talked about leptocephalus.
Or was it just a post on the Grayling Report, or both?
Probably both, because I know we've talked about this on the program previously, and I've had a lot of articles published about my leptocephalus theory over the years.
Because this is the thing I'm very, very interested in.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, it is
a gigantic eel larva.
Well, think about this.
For God's sakes, listen so you can learn more.
Well, here's the whole point, and we're getting short on time during this segment. We're going to be joined by Nancy Dutartre, author of Psychic Intuition, here in mere minutes. But I do just want to throw this out there to people, okay? this object, this creature, whatever it was seen in 1960 by Dr. Walford and his group of several dozen men. Anton Bruhn pulled up a 6-foot-long translucent leptocephalus, which seems to be what these creatures are. And I decided today I would look around and see if I could find any more evidence of giant eel larva, leptocephalus, translucent eel larva, or larva that are actually larger, because you got to keep in mind, the largest conger eel, I believe, on record was probably between 11 and 12 feet long. I think the largest moray eel may have been somewhere in the neighborhood of 15, 16 feet long. And generally, the larva, the leptocephalus, generally, in most instances, is about 1/30th of the size of the full-grown animal. Now, there are a few rare instances with certain varieties of eel or other eel-like or similar creatures that the leptocephalus larva is roughly a third or a half the length of the large animal. But let me just put this to you. Okay, let's just say that a 6-foot-long leptocephalus, okay, we're only half the length of the adult. That's still going to be 12 feet long. Now, Dr. Walford in 1960 described seeing a creature that was close to 80 feet long as it undulated along out there in the ocean. And generally speaking, these eel larvae that are very large, they're clearly some sort of a larva, okay, but of unknown origin. And in most cases, eel larvae are representative, again, in most cases, of about 1/30th, 1/25th to 1/30th the length of the full-grown animal, which seems to indicate to us that if these larvae, when they're pulled up and discovered from time to time, these giant eel larvae are any indication of how big the adult specimen could get, I think we have a very plausible explanation for sea serpents. Okay, and so I decided I would look around and see if there were any other stories along these lines that exist elsewhere on the web, and I found this. And this appeared in the Japanese Journal of Ichthyology back in 1970. Okay, so a lot of people in the United States aren't very aware of this report. Okay, for many of you, this will be, as a matter of fact, I would probably say for 99% of our listeners, this will have been the first time you'll ever have heard of this. The report is called A Giant Leptocephalus from the Sea off Northern Peru by Osame Tabeta. He said, since the first record of giant leptocephali in 1954, he didn't mention Anton Bruhn's, which was not scientifically credited by many because the specimen was lost. Okay. Several large specimens, though not so great as the first ones, have been reported. In the trawl fishing ground off Patia, northern Peru, a remarkable leptocephalus of about 75 centimeters in total length was collected with a trawl net in December of 1968 by the author of the report, which I'm reading to you now, who was a member of a scientific expedition on fishes off Peru and Chile. The specimen herein treated ranks the fourth in its size ever recorded. Prior to the detailed study currently in progress, the brief description and the collection data on this specimen are preliminarily reported in this paper. They say the specimen is a very large leptocephalus, conspicuously elongated and laterally compressed with filamentous caudal parts behind its rear portions. Now, before we get into too much of the specifics, I want to skip ahead to another portion of this report that's far more interesting here. The leptocephalus, the eel larva that is, was found without any damage, moving windingly on the wing part of the trawl net just heaved up, together with some amphipod crustaceans. Judging from the fact that these animals were alive for a few minutes on the deck after dislodging from the net, they seem to have been entangled in the net and the upper water layer during the course of heaving the net. The author wishes to express his gratitude to several professors who helped with this, and then other than that, this report primarily only really details certain taxonomical and biological characteristics, you know, of relevance to researchers in this report. There is a very crude photograph, but this is an old print, and it's very difficult to discern much from the photograph there. The point is, however, that this is indeed a scientific paper, and I've found that there are indeed many that exist that deal with the very, very sparing number of reports of giant leptocephalus that have been discovered over the years. Now, people can hee-haw and poo-poo stories about sea serpents all they want to, but I want to just tell you this. And sure, we should remain skeptical, knowing that not all leptocephalus grow to be 30 times larger when they are an adult eel specimen. But I do want to point out that most of them, generally, in the larval stage are much smaller, a fraction of the size of the adult, and that there are indeed reports of some very, very, very large serpentine animals seen out there in the deep oceans. So what are those? And are people who claim to see those really out of their minds, or is there some sort of a plausible basis for the existence of what, for lack of a better term, we could call sea serpents? Interesting that so many of these eels, although they're probably more closely related to fishes, seem to have reptile-esque terms in their actual scientific names. Anyway, when we come back, we'll be discussing psychic intuition here on the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have sent children into fits of rage.
I am responsible for a child's speech impediment.
I am the reason a child can't read.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
What can we learn from our ancient past? What is the mystery behind UFOs? Did aliens visit humankind in ancient times? Each of these tests the very boundaries of humankind's ability to reason, and all will be explored this year at the Paradigm Symposium 2012, October 18th through 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Speakers will include Eric Von Daniken, author of Chariots of the Gods, George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, as well as Giorgio Tsoukalos, Bill Burns, Philip Coppens, and many more. Tickets are selling fast, so reserve yours online today by visiting ParadigmSymposium.com. Reviewing our past and changing our future. For more information, visit ParadigmSymposium.com.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grayling Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the program, my friends. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, and this, my friends, is the Grayling Report. It's always our pleasure, our privilege, to be able to broadcast to you from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma each and every week. So excited that you were able to join us. So glad to see you. Just like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, well, we are your kind, warm, and welcoming voice in the darkness. I would hate to have encountered Fred Rogers in the dark room, but anyway, all kidding aside, I have to put up with these guys each week in a fairly dark room, Mr. Chris Hayes and Matt Oakley.
Well, you're not being very fair to Fred Rogers, because from what I understand, he was actually genuinely one of the best human beings who's ever walked the face of the
planet. I'm just kidding. I love Fred Rogers. Okay. Why do you think I quote Fred Rogers all the time?
Also, he was Marine Corps Special Forces, so.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, we should do a tribute to Fred Rogers here on the Grayling Report. I would like to do that sometime. I actually admire Fred Rogers. I have, in seriousness, quoted the man many times. One of my favorites is, and there was a whole family that lived next door, and they used to dress like raccoons, and they used to do a dance. Have you ever been next door to where the raccoon family lives? You know, I used to know a family of raccoons that lived next door. I love Fred Rogers.
It's really profound.
Fred happens to be one of the, I don't know if you really call him broadcaster, but he was certainly one of the greatest, probably one of the best known, what would you call him?
Personalities?
Yeah, I guess television personalities that's ever really come along. So anyway, he was a remarkable individual. And speaking of remarkable individuals, I want to say also that tonight we are blessed to have a very wonderful guest with us. Nancy Dutartre is an attorney who became a trained psychic detective, spiritual medium, medical intuitive, and a paranormal investigator. But she's not your average paranormal investigator. She happens to be a magna cum laude graduate of Princeton University as well, and her latest book is called Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know. When our publicists at New Page Books sent along information about Nancy and her new book, I was very fascinated by this, and I'll tell you the reason primarily for that is because of, I don't claim to have a whole lot of at least maybe any more than the average person in terms of an intuitive ability, okay? But I definitely got a funny feeling about Nancy. I thought that she would just be ideal to talk to for some reason with regard to psychic intuition and how people can claim to develop this sort of thing for themselves. So if the black government will just give us one evening with Nancy so that we can talk to her and actually hear her. So you say that you don't feel like this is necessarily something you were gifted with, but that you maybe developed over time. Is that correct?
I absolutely was not gifted with it whatsoever. I mean, I was born into this very academic family. They thought that psychiatrists were quacks. So psychics were off the charts. I mean, we didn't talk about anything to do with psychic. I didn't have really any psychic experiences. I had, one or two weird things, and I didn't know what to do with them. So I, shelved them. They were just, weird experiences. But I didn't experience all those things that, psychics and mediums talk about experiencing. I didn't know what they were.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up having a very strong experience when I was a practicing attorney in New York, which I can go into, if you want me to. But basically what happened was that even with that, such a strong experience, I said, I don't know what that is. It's just too weird, and I don't know what to do with it. And it's not anywhere in my repertoire of life. So it wasn't until I started to work on this book, which I thought was going to be a book about the psychology of intuition, that I ended up actually training and getting apprenticed to a psychic detective and working with mediums and medical intuitives. And at that point, I began to realize, but it took me a long time. I actually had abilities, and I kept saying, that's got to be luck. I'm thinking, I'm guessing, it's coincidence. I mean, I chalked it up to anything and everything in order to deny it. And at a certain point, if you get enough feedback, you got to say, okay, there's something going on here. And if you don't do that, well, then you're stuck in your own belief system, which a lot of people are.
I certainly think that applies to a lot of different walks of life today. People are stuck in their belief systems. But, after a while, and this is, again, how I would word it, I'm very careful, very, very careful to say that I myself have had psychic experiences, but there are only two people maybe outside my family members who know what I'm about to talk about right now, and Nancy, you're one of them, because I was corresponding.
Thank you.
I know, you see, we're close already, and this is really our first time talking, but I shared a very personal experience with you this morning.
Yeah.
Because I thought that it may have a potential to compromise this program this week. And without getting into all the details, I'd had an unsettling premonition last night while I was visiting my grandparents, and then this morning I received a phone call that explained that my grandfather had been having heart palpitations and extreme weakness and had been taken to the emergency room. And so needless to say, I literally was in mid-correspondence with you, Nancy, while I heard this information, and while feeling somewhat vindicated about the feeling I'd had last night, I was incredibly upset for obvious reasons, and I remember you'd emailed and you said, just trust your gut and go do what you've got to do today. Now fortunately, he's at home, he is well, and he's visiting the cardiologist tomorrow, but to be in his 90s, he's a family member that we all have to kind of keep a special eye on. And yet I tell you, last night, I hesitate to say I'm psychic or anything like that, but there definitely I had a feeling. And boy, was I ever right, How often does that sort of thing happen to you, Nancy?
But that's exactly what it is. And everybody is so either ashamed or afraid of saying I am psychic, because we all have these preconceptions about what that means. And it's gotten sort of a bad reputation. And all it is a way of, the way that I talk about it and define it, it's an openness and a receptivity to sensory experience. And if you're that, you know, sensitive enough and you can capture it in your conscious awareness, you get much more information than the average Joe who is, you know, walking around and these things are kind of invisible because he's not tuning into them, but you are. And so there's absolutely no shame in saying that. I mean, that is a psychic experience. It doesn't mean you are a psychic. I mean, that's a whole other conversation.
Sure.
But, you know, what you've done or what your body or your brain or your spirit has done is it has allowed you into this kind of like a window of experience, vibrational experience, which is beyond our normal five senses in terms of time and distance. And that's all it is.
You know, and I've heard, you know, there's another very famous psychic, Robert Cracknell, another friend of mine, who has said that to him, psychic experiences maybe aren't exactly, and I think maybe that you get into this in your book just a little bit too, but he says that maybe we shouldn't look at psychic ability or the perceived ability of the psychic as being a sixth sense, you know, of any sort. If anything, really, it should be that we are using our five senses and the other more subtle senses that humans are equipped with in ways that allow us to perceive things that are all out there, that they're all ever-present and all around us, but that most people either tune out or have not really just honed an ability to detect. You know, there is a chapter in your book titled The Sixth Sense is a Myth. Do you believe that that's the case and that the sixth sense really isn't what we're dealing with, but it's people that are utilizing a heightened ability with their existing senses that are already known?
Yeah, I totally don't believe in the sixth sense. I think that people have called it that because it's sort of this like mystery grab bag, and you toss everything in there that you don't quite understand, and you say, well, that's got to be a sixth sense. And first of all, we know that we have many more than just five senses. There, scientists are now speculating we may have 40, at least 40, maybe more senses. And actually, I think that it's going to be shown that we have hundreds of senses, because I think you can take almost every neurological difficulty and you can turn it into the lack of a sense.
Uh-huh. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and just think about, you know, again, these are things that people overlook almost every day, the ability to sense heat and cold or pressure or even things like barometric changes and whatnot. I believe our producer Chris Hayes wanted to chime in for a moment as well.
Yeah, just the whole idea of it not being a sixth sense. I'm not really sure about the whole 30 or 40 additional senses. I don't even know what context that could be used in, but I've always said an idea like being, you know, quote unquote psychic, or the idea of psi, is less, you know, like you said, a gift, and more something like a Sherlock Holmes like level of being intuitive or observation.
Right. Sherlock Holmes, the character, yes, he was a person who was hyper observant, you know, and I think that in a way, people who have psychic abilities are, whether they're utilizing senses or maybe they're gleaning some sort of other information from the environment in some other way. You know, for all we know, that could certainly be supernatural, but they're definitely doing something that the average person doesn't do, and maybe that there is some sort of science behind it. Now, in your book, you delve into that and to explaining that maybe there is some sort of a science behind this, and that the psychic abilities, as we call them, are a trainable skill. How does one train and cultivate this sort of ability?
It's kind of a strange thing. You can't, if you start out saying, well, I'm not psychic, I never had a psychic experience, and I don't get it, the concept of training to do it seems kind of odd, because you're training to do something that doesn't exist for you. So it's really, speaking from my own personal experience, and I'm a very logical, very analytic person, what it took for me was to be able to... Actually, it was two important things. One, not to be afraid of making a fool out of myself, because when you say these things, you can't back them up. You can't reverse engineer the thought and say, oh, well, I said that because based on this and this and that information and this and this. It's coming out of nowhere. So you feel like an idiot because you can't back it up. And what if you're wrong? So the second piece of this is that you've really got to learn how to trust your sensations. And that means you got to learn how to recognize what the sensations are. And the only way that you can do this is by sort of going out on a limb and then getting feedback and confirmation. If you don't get the feedback, you're never going to learn what it, you know, how a proper psychic sense, what that feels like. And it does feel different, and it's really, really, really hard to explain. There's maybe the best way to explain it is that it seems, for me, it seems to be a kind of an image or a thought or a sound that circles back again. It comes back. It doesn't quite let go, but it still feels very familiar. It kind of feels like a thought. And you have to learn how to distinguish
between the normal thoughts, that is, and then these impressions, if you will, that kind of come.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that that's certainly the case just as well. In my own experience, you know, I prefer, I guess, you know, again, though, I think I keep tossing this kind of you know, semantic issue around. Well, I don't really like to call it psychic. Well, I don't really, but you know, as you pointed out, I think that maybe it's not so much that calling it psychic is a problem. It's what kind of meaning people append to that word. And for me, obviously, I've learned that just in the short course of this present conversation, that I think my difficulty with terming what I experience personally as being psychic or intuitive has been my experience seeing what psychic intuitives claim to do. And yet I know many people who I believe do have some sort of if you want to call it, extrasensory ability. They do have this. They do seem to be able to exhibit this ability consistently, and with you know, a fair amount of success, and I've even had these experiences myself. And again, it's almost like a circumstance where, for me, when I've gotten an impression, I once had an impression come to mind of a gravestone with a man's name on it, and the following day I heard that this man had died. But that image showing up in my mind, you know, at the time it occurred, I couldn't have distinguished that, you know, from your average thought in any way. It was only in retrospect, looking back, that I realized, oh, huh, that's interesting. And hence, I guess I gravitate toward the term synchronicity. Does that thought, that so-called impression, differ really from a thought in any way otherwise that one can, you know, kind of help learn to distinguish the two?
It's really subtle and it's really complicated. It's not the kind of thing you can sort of explain in, you know, 5 minutes or less.
Sure.
but what I can tell you is that since I do... My theory on psychic ability is all sensory-based, and it has to do with a little bit similar to what you were talking about before. I mean, I think that we have it's clear, we have the ability to pick up information that is beyond the normal spectrum of our senses, you know, on either end. And, in fact, in every second, we experience 11 million bits of sensory information. We're only consciously aware of 16. Now, that means that all those other, I'm not going to calculate 11 million minus 16, but whatever it is, all of that's reaching our body. And it's you know, we are experiencing it, but not in our conscious awareness. So where does it go? I think what happens is that it gets into our body, not necessarily through our five sensory organs, but it gets into our bodies on a molecular level, and it goes to this place that we all kind of dismiss as the imagination. And I believe the imagination is our largest sensory organ, and it's there that the brain makes these interpretations about all of these vibrational bits of information that we're getting. And that's, you know, either you're aware of that and you allow your imagination to actually sort of speak through you and you make predictions, or you don't, or you just dismiss it. You say, nah, you know, my imagination is this little private little fantasy land that I have. I don't think so. I think that's why we can read each other's minds. We're all interconnected, and if it's based on sensory information, well, then, you know, it's all shared. This is not private stuff.
That's a beautifully profound way of putting that, Nancy. You know, and that, if anything, almost reminds me just a bit of Carl Jung's idea of the collective unconscious, if you will. A colleague of mine, Dr. Maxim Kammerer, and I were recently corresponding about a similar idea, in which he believes that people actually think that, if anything, that perception itself is the root of a lot of the paranormal experiences that people have. And that, and in the way I'm tying this in here is that if human perception is some level of phenomena unto itself, that a lot of paranormal phenomena and maybe even psychic phenomena could stem from that that perception. And of course, our imaginations influence the way that we perceive the world. The eye alone and what we see clearly is not all that there really is. Everything is filtered through perception and the way that our minds choose to interpret and imagine different scenarios based on that. So yeah, I think you're very right in the sense that imagination could be, you know, if anything, a very useful tool even in helping to understand the ins and the outs of this sort of an ability. Now,
well, if you think about color, color does not exist in the universe.
Ah, yes.
You know, it's just a vibration, but our brain interprets it a certain way. And if you admit that color is a kind of imagination, then you can start to understand that if you allow in all these other imaginary thoughts and give them some credence and say, well, you know, maybe that's related to something, test it. If you test your imagination, you will be shocked by how accurate a lot of it is.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's fascinating. And that gets a little bit into the realm of studies of what they call embodied cognition. But I'm afraid I'm digressing again. We are talking with Nancy Dutartre. Nancy, am I pronouncing your last name correctly? I was very concerned about that earlier today, as you know.
Everybody's concerned about it.
I certainly am. But I want Dutartre. Is that correct?
Oh, that's pretty close. That's not bad.
Pretty close. You'd said two turtles might do it if I
yes.
If all else failed. But yeah, I prefer not to call you Nancy Two Turtles. Although
I don't mind.
It's nonetheless fairly charming. Yeah, but charm isn't what I'm best known for. Oh, sure it is, actually.
I'm sure it is.
I'm quite the charmer. You can probably hear it in my voice. But no. Dutartre. I wanted to make sure that I was at least getting that
it's
fairly close. It's what? Now give it to me one more time there. I'm sorry.
Duterte.
See, there we go. I'm sorry. See, I wasn't even close. Chris?
I was actually trying to mouth that over the without
Chris,
making
you
look silly again.
You should have used your intuition, Chris.
We did the cards. I don't have that.
You know, Nancy, we did an experiment here on the program recently with the famous Zener cards. Am I pronouncing Zener right?
Yeah.
And we tried that with Chris and everything. You know, I think actually who did the best here of all of us? Was it Matt? Matt did the best, our engineer.
Yeah, nice.
He actually did the best. Nancy, have you ever worked with any of those kinds of more classical, I guess, psychic experiments and things like that before?
Oh, sure. I mean, I teach this stuff, so yeah, I have handed those out to my students, had them work with them. I think what that tests sort of a certain ability, and I think if you're not particularly good at it, it doesn't necessarily mean you're not psychic.
Sure.
Some people, I think everybody tunes into a different primary sense. Like, I'm primarily visual.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are auditory, whatever. And sometimes these, you know, sort of 50-50 flips of the coin or, you know, with definite results like that, you can be somewhat clairvoyant about it, but that may not be your principal strength.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I have a funny question for you. How do you think luck plays into this? When it comes to intuition, is luck even a factor that can work in with any of this in any capacity?
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I actually was having a conversation about luck today with somebody.
Ah, synchronicity
and,
yet again.
Yeah, we kind of decided that if you work with the definition that I have, that if you open up your conscious awareness to more and more subtle degrees of sensory inputs, there's really no such thing as luck.
Hmm.
You know, I'm sure you must have had some kind of experience. I mean, for example, all right, I've driven down the highway, you know, in the lane that I always drive in that lane, you know, on the slow lane on that particular round, because I know I'm going to make an exit pretty soon. On one particular day, I don't know why, I just changed into the middle lane. Immediately after that, trucks that were way up ahead of me had an accident and started dropping these huge, like, iron log things.
Oh, wow.
And it would have been a real disaster for me.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking to somebody today who said, you know, I normally take a certain route in order to get to Philadelphia. And for whatever reason, today, I chose not to do that. And I got a ticket for, you know, holding my cell phone. And in a sense, you know, that's luck. You can either create good luck or bad luck, but somewhere along the line, if you're receiving information on that level, you've already made that decision.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
So no, I don't really believe in that much luck. No.
You know, the reason I asked is because, you know, with some of the early Ryan Institute studies, you know, I recently visited the Ryan Institute.
Yeah.
And they had described that one of their early participants in a lot of their studies had presented himself to J.B. Ryan, and his wording was that, you know, I seem to have better luck than the average guy, and maybe that would be helpful to you. And when he would do the tests, the different experiments with the Zener cards and things like that, he often would get, for instance, 7-8 correct guesses in a row. This guy, as he termed it, had incredible luck, but was it just luck, or was he influencing the outcome of those occurrences himself with some sort of innate ability? I guess you would probably gravitate toward the latter explanation, right?
Well, you can possibly influence, but I feel that it's more a sense of gravitating towards the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can, I do believe you can influence certain things, and that sort of gets into a whole other topic. There's also, I mean, with the cards, and I forget the name, but there's a name for, you know, not just a streak of good luck, but when you have an extraordinary streak of bad luck, it's actually indicative of the fact that you have a psychic ability. You've just flipped it the other way.
Ah. Exactly. You know, Nancy, we've got to take a short break. When we come back from this break, I want to ask you about something a little different. In fact, when it comes to interpreting things going on around us, and if we putting out certain kinds of energies ourselves can influence that. If you'll hang on the line, we'll come back right after this and discuss that. You know, a lot of this kind of has to do with, well, you know, we hear it referred to today as the law of attraction and these sorts of things. In other words, can we put out certain energies to the universe and those kinds of energies somehow come back to us based on the energies that we're putting out? How much of it actually has to do with energy? Who knows? But we'll discuss that with our guest when we return here on the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks.
Hey guys, Jamie Havoc in here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology, the best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out. And keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havkin.
Back to the program. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, joined in studio as always by Chris Hayes and Matthew Oakley, the engineer with the kind eyes. He is our kind-eyed engineer, and indeed he is a wonderful guy to have running our board here at Master Console. As a matter of fact, I think that should just be your new nickname, Matt. We'll just call you Master Console. I have to apologize because despite my best efforts tonight not to mispronounce Nancy Duterte's name, I think I'm probably still doing it, but are you laughing at me, Chris? What? He's laughing at me. Goodness gracious. Nancy, are you with us?
Yes, I think you've just made me slightly Italian. That's fine.
The Mouth of the South, he's an intellectual of sorts, but I'll tell you this. he does get a little tongue-tied at the time. Sometimes he even suffers what I've been told is similar to diarrhea of the tongue, running off at the mouth. Something like that. But then again, it's my Barry White-esque voice that people really like listening to. Anyway, Chris, would you like to reintroduce our guest for me, please?
No, I think you did it just fine.
Thanks, Chris. Goodness gracious. Nancy, you know, I wonder sometimes about when it comes to our ability to influence our reality and the world around us. When we put out certain energies, do we literally have the ability to change the outcome events or the outcome of certain events in our lives, the outcome of maybe certain desires that we have by those sorts of energies that we're putting out, i.e. maybe what some refer to as the law of attraction? What are your feelings on that?
Absolutely. I mean, of course. We already know that we have, it's already been shown that we have an electromagnetic force that comes off of our body anyway, and our thoughts have certain forces. And anything that's electromagnetic, obviously, is going to go traveling through the universe. That's what waves do. They travel, and each time they bump into something, they change it. So, you know, just on that real simple level, yeah, of course, I do think. I mean, and it's been shown power of prayer, for example, can make changes, and it can be done. Power of healing, I mean, I do energy work, and it's astounding to me, you know, what happens when I never touch anybody. But the energy of whatever the intentions are that are being worked with, it's amazing.
You know, energy work is something that's fascinating to me just as well. As I understand, Uri Geller actually in recent years has gotten into that a bit, and he gives you quite an endorsement on the cover of your book. Have you met Uri by chance?
Yes, I know him quite well.
Oh, fantastic. So what are your feelings about Uri? You know, Uri, he has really kind of run the gamut in terms of his very unique abilities. But then again, there are those out there who, you know, like many in this field, have unfortunately had to weather. He's weathered a lot of attacks about his abilities and whether or not he is, you know, really the real deal, the genuine article, or if he is more of a showman. I would maybe argue that he is somewhere in between. He's the real deal, but someone who also knows how to present it in a very marketable way. What do you think about Uri Geller, since you know him?
He's bent spoons for me. I've been to his house. I have, in terms of the spoon bending, and I, you know, I learned from magician friends of mine before I went to visit him how you can bend a spoon, you know, using magic, because I wanted to see what that looked like, what to look for, and what a bent spoon that was bent that way would look like. And so I watched him very, 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 very closely. There was maybe a split second where the spoon was out of my sight, and I decided, well, because that, like, you know, what you would call, in at least in legal terms, you know, the chain of custody was broken that way, I couldn't make 100% decision, so I wasn't sure. His background is that he was trained in magic, he performed using magic tricks, but also he was very clear in saying, you know, I have this psychic ability. He did teleportation. I have friends of mine who witnessed things that he was doing, materialization, dematerialization. And it wasn't until recently when I was talking with him, and he actually had asked me, we were talking about where I live, and he said, oh, don't you live in, and I'm not going to give you the name of the town, but the name of the town was a place where I lived like 20 years ago. And there's no way that anybody could have researched that or anybody could have known that, and he was highly specific. So I knew at that point, I had no doubt in my mind. Of course he's got the ability. And yes, he got slammed by all kinds of skeptics because they seem to think, and it's a very, in order to have to think this way, you really have to work at it, but they seem to think that if you can replicate something by magic, that means psychic doesn't work. It doesn't exist. And right. That's simply incorrect logic. It just means that you can produce the same or similar result through magic that you can through psychic means. But you've got to accept the fact that there's this other pathway. Or just keep your mind open to the fact that there might be a different pathway.
I've heard some incredible stories about some of the spirit mediums of the 19th century, and actually the early 20th century, in fact. You know, one of our fellow researchers and correspondents for this program, Mr. Vance Pollock, has done a lot of extensive research into an obscure American medium by the name of Bertie Lilly Candler. He managed to find a young, well, she's an elderly woman now, but at the time had been a young girl who attended one of these seances. Her father had been murdered, or at least we'll say found dead under very mysterious circumstances. And they had attended a seance following his death, and the woman recalled very vividly that under the mediumship of Miss Candler, that not only did this man appear in their presence, but that he had had a tendency to undo his tie in a certain way and pull it off to the side when he would come home from work, and that when Dad appeared in the spectral form during the seance, that he came out of the spirit closet, which was a popular medium for you know, producing spirits back in the old days. He came out, he had the tie pulled off to the side like that, and told them things that only those family members there present could have possibly known. And she said, as a young girl even, I knew clearly that this was my father, my deceased father, standing right there. And he told us that indeed it had been a murder. He had been involved in the pharmaceutical community, and that he had been involved in a very revolutionary kind of medicine that would have changed a lot of people's lives, and that they had basically taken him out to preserve the monetary gain from, you know, issuing less effective medicines. That was his fate, and he came forth and he told us that during that seance. Despite there being these kinds of stories that come out from time to time, most people equate the 19th century spiritualist movement and the channelers and the mediums with hucksterism, and, you know, with fraudulent people who were going out there, charlatans who were just trying to, you know, benefit from, you know, cashing in on the gullible. But that very well may not have been the case. There indeed had to have been a few of them, I would imagine, that were actual, you know, mediums, if you will, and who displayed some sort of an actual gift. Unfortunately, their reputation, of course, was tarnished by the few who went out there probably trying to either just get attention, if not something else.
Absolutely. I mean, I know that this stuff works. I know it exists, and the story you just told doesn't surprise me, because when I do psychic detective work, I'm usually tuning in to the victim of whatever the crime was. And yes, you can get information. Sometimes they may actually show up. Sometimes you'll see them with your physical eyes. Sometimes you'll see them with your third eye or your imagination. But you get information, and it's clear and it's accurate. I really see that my mission at this point is to bring this into mainstream and to get people to understand this is a natural human physiological ability, and that if it permits you an opening into, you know, something interdimensional or spiritual, you know, go with it, accept it. You know, don't run from it and decide, oh, that's crazy talk.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, with regard to your psychic detective work, you know, we're almost out of time with you tonight, but I do want to ask you about your psychic detective work. You know, you are, of course, an attorney. You graduated magna cum laude from Princeton University. You are the kind of person, you know, who has, you know, you've obviously been successful and have you know, done very well prior to getting involved in psychic work. There had to be you know, its own brand of challenges, I guess, associated with making that transition. And when you put yourself in a situation where you're going to lay yourself open to doing psychic detective work, in other words, gleaning information from an environment or from a circumstance that often has to do with murders, kidnappings, crimes, you know, the darker elements of our existence, that's opening yourself up to an entirely new realm of danger. What was that process like for you, as you said, being trained to become a psychic detective?
The process is fine. I think that when you have experiences that suddenly get verified, it really freaks you out. You just go, whoa, you know, because you didn't expect that this crazy talk that you had in your head, you know, and I'm using that in quotations, crazy talk, because it isn't, that all of a sudden you find out, oh, wow, that's for real. You know, you find out where I've had situations where I have figured out where bodies are located, or at least where the only locations where law enforcement has looked for the bodies, and very, very, very specifically. So it's a little bit of it's like a confirmation, you know. And yes, you do get yourself into these. I do think that you can sometimes burn out that way. Same way that, you know, I've worked with on a book with a New York City homicide detective, and I know that, you know, he got burnt out doing the real thing. And you can get just as burnt out on a very spiritual, emotional level doing this kind of psychic detective work, because it can get creepy. And when you're working with real creepy people, or you're not dealing with actual blood and guts, mm-hmm. but in some sense you are. And you have to be, I think it takes a certain type of, or a certain breed of psychic to do this kind of work. A lot of them won't do it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I can entirely see why so many of them wouldn't do it. And that said, I noticed Ingo Swann also, who'd been the creator of the famous CIA remote viewing psychic spy program many decades ago, he also gave an endorsement on your book just as well. The remote viewing process, putting yourself in a situation, an alien sometimes situation, that must be incredibly trying. I would even argue that although, as you said, you're not dealing with blood and guts, the process of remote viewing to these sorts of locations, if you will, to borrow Ingo's term, you know, or just if you want to call it psychic detective work, whatever else, I would say that sometimes getting into the minds and the scenarios involved in these sorts of things might be even more unsettling sometimes than the physical end of it that the forensics experts and types would get out there and be involved with. So in that sense, I have to say, it's very brave work that you do, and Nancy, it's been our pleasure to have you here on the program with us here on the Grailian Report. If you would, please tell our listeners a little bit more about how they can find out about you and follow your work, please.
Anybody could get in touch with me on my website, which is theskepticalpsychic.com, and, you know, I can be reached there, and you can find out anything you want to about me there.
Excellent. And since you do it so beautifully, would you please, for me one time, just for my own personal use, would you pronounce your last name for me one more time so that in the future when I have you back on the program, I will not mess it up?
You know what? If you think two turtles, it's going to work out just fine. It's Duterte, but don't worry about it.
Two turtles, Duterte. I'm going to get it one of these days. Chris is laughing because I still haven't got it. But Nancy Duterte, thank you for joining us on the program. I certainly hope you'll be back. And I told you, I have a feeling, call it intuition if you will, that we'll be working with you some more in the future. So Nancy, thank you so much for joining us as our guest tonight on the Grailian Report.
Totally my pleasure.
Oh, we'll have
thank
you back
you.
Soon. It's been our pleasure. And of course, her new book is Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know. It's available at the website of newpagebooks.com as well as Amazon. Nancy, we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds good.
Take care. And that was Nancy, whose name I will continue to work on pronouncing. She does it so beautifully, but then again, I guess she's had a lifetime of being able to pronounce her own name in that manner.
You're trying to roll the R's like it's Spanish.
Show me one more time.
Duterte.
See, now
just
I can do it.
Just don't even say the R.
See, now I got it.
There you go.
What happened? What there? Duterte. See, I knew I was supposed to be listening to my my former French instructor, who's now hit the high road and headed to the land of the Windy City, actually, of Chicago. So I don't know. If we go visit my former French instructor, maybe we'll be able to visit our good friends up there. Tom Cameron and so many of you others out there who hang out in the Windy City. We'll wrap things up when we come back right here on the Grailian Report.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project, we never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
Welcome back, my friends. Jump back on board. Promise you this ship isn't sinking anytime soon. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. What a fascinating interview. Nancy just sent a very nice message off the air, thanking us for having her on the program. And of course, it's our pleasure. You know, I think that some of my very favorite guests to talk about on this program or talk with are those who are psychics. You know, Robert Cracknell, Nancy just this evening, and Rita, of course, Dr. Rita Louise. We had her on the program. Rita and I have become very good friends. We actually spent all weekend hanging out when I was out there in Sacramento, California, Anthony Sanchez's conference. Anthony put on a fantastic event in Sacramento back during the summer, and so Scotty Roberts and Rita and I were all there together. And I've found that, I don't know why, but those who are of the psychic persuasion, if you will, are the ones that, in terms of who come on this program, I probably have the best relationships with in the long term. So, but when it comes to doing special things with your mind, psychic phenomena may not be all that there is to be desired. For instance, this recent story. Boy, this is just mind-blowing. I've got to send this to Caleb Hanks to discuss, being our resident transhuman expert, because this, well, I'll just read the headline to you. Think Hard to Fly. Chinese scientists have unveiled a mind-controlled drone. Yeah, I teased that we'd talk about this earlier in the program. And indeed, what we are looking at here is we see a video of a man who is in a wheelchair. He has a bit of headgear that is linked up to a Bluetooth, which allows him to control remotely a little helicopter drone. I have to say, this is pretty remarkable. We are the advents in technology that are coming up today. And here's what's amazing to me about this. This is really utilizing technology that's been in existence for years, but doing so in a way that combines existent technologies and allows a new kind of innovation. Okay, what they're doing is they're feeding information to a computer using EEG signals collected from the brain via Bluetooth, okay, converting these into specific commands that are delivered by the computer to a remote control drone using Wi-Fi. Okay, so let's look at the technology available here. EEG signals, Bluetooth technology. Okay, computers broadcasting via Wi-Fi, utilized and combined in a manner so that the participant is able to control a drone with his or her mind. Here's essentially how it works. You have to think certain things to be able to cause the drone to move. For instance, if you want it to lift off, you have to think of a certain thing. If you want it to fly to the left, you need to be able to think left, but you need to do so lightly. In other words, imagine focusing on something and just think left. But if you want to, for instance, put this thing down on the ground or raise it up off the ground, you need to be able to think left hard. Think left. I mean, really left. That's going to put this puppy on the ground. But if you just think left or think right, boom. It's going to actually move with your thoughts. And you learn, this is kind of like biofeedback therapy. You learn to train your mind to think a certain way by incorporating your thought patterns along with some sort of a physical representation that you see before you. And this is what's even most interesting. Get this. I love this, okay? Now, remember how they tell you to avoid blinking when you take photos? Well, here it's just the opposite. When you blink, that's the command that tells the drone to photograph its environment. So not only can you remotely control a drone when you close your eyes. Now, granted, I think if you just blink, it's going to ignore, you know, just random, you know, blinking that you're going to do. But if you close your eyes for just a few moments, that tells the drone to snap a photograph. So completely hands-free, remote control drone technology controlled with your mind. You know, in its own way, that might even, to some degree, constitute some sort of psychic phenomena. Because really, how do we designate psychic phenomena? Let's do a quick experiment. We've only got about a minute left here. Matt, clap your hands. Okay. Now see, I spoke to you, but aside from me speaking, I did very little else to issue a physical response several feet away from me. I didn't have to pick up anything and move it with my hands. You know, And to me, that's interesting because we could say in a sense that I have issued a command. You know, I have externalized a thought without actually going and physically moving your hands and bringing them together and causing them to clap, and nonetheless have actually caused some sort of a reaction to occur. But that all has to do with communication. I couldn't tell that rock laying over there on that side of the cave to roll off the side of the wall, you know, or I couldn't tell that cricket over there to stop chirping. You know, there has to be a communication, a signal is sent out, and then it is received, interpreted, and then acted upon. So I wonder sometimes, you know, when it comes to psychic phenomena and the like, well, you know, what exactly constitutes this or that, and you know, how much, as we kind of learned from our discussion with Nancy, how much of this stuff really is all in, well, the wording we use. I'll tell you one thing. I don't think I'm going to be as hesitant to use the expression psychic in reference to my own synchronistic happenings in the future, especially after our discussion with Nancy Duterte. Close enough, huh? On behalf of Chris Hayes, Matt Oakley, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, and of course yours truly, Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, we bid you adieu, my friends, and until next time, stay strange.